Welcome to a special podcast edition of BeatTheChip.org, and we are featuring a special interview with Greg Nicoletos. He is the producer of the film One Mainframe to Rule Them All. And what's important about this film is that it is the first to single out another corporation other than Verichip. So, Greg, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, exactly. You hail from a long way away. We've conferred with other international activists, and this would be the second interview we've done with someone from overseas that actually has some of the identical problems, identical concerns to our own. And it seems like there is a globalized agenda to try to get us on one mainframe and to integrate and centralize as much data and use data lust as possible. Part of it feeds into the kind of greed dynamic, but some of it is just this kind of weird big brothery omnipotence and kind of a panopticon, which the British know a ton about. And I learned more and more about that kind of omniscience and the psychological controls that people use from the idea that they're being watched. So we all are kind of struggling with the nuances of emerging technology. And this microchip and your site was one of the first sites that we discovered. No2ID was the first, and then your site was the second, I would say, to kind of go anywhere near the fact that there was a problem with internalized microchipping. So I want to hear a little bit about first the film, and then we can talk about some of the politics in Australia and some of the things that you're doing to advocate against this, either to the corporation and dealing with them directly or to your government or both. So Greg?
Yeah, well, look, One Mainframe to Rule Them All was a short film that we've done, which is part of a trilogy. And the reason it had to be done was because IBM, at the end of the day, seed-funded Verichip, which is, the human implantable microchip, there needed to be a case of if one looks at the actual Verichip implant itself and you have concerns about it, it is best to look into the closet of the actual company that owns it, and then let's actually have a look at how this company has conducted themselves in history. So for us, it was a case of showcasing the alliance, obviously, with Nazi Germany and IBM and the Hollerith machine. And we had to get specific experts in the field, namely Edwin Black from IBM and the Holocaust. So that way the information that was presented not only in a credible way, but also from a historical perspective that was totally bulletproof. And by then doing that, we can then obviously, sound the alarm and say to people, look, is it possible that history could repeat if we let it? So for us, it was really the bedrock and the foundation for the actual movie, so that way we can actually move it more into the current time of what people are facing on a biometric level, or the war on terror, or immigration issues and the like. So yeah, that's about it on the actual movie.
So how long did it take you to film and edit and everything comprehensively? When did the production, the idea, the scripting, all of this, when did it start?
We have a total of, there was really, we did one short film, which was, very low budget. It was just a case of getting the message out there, which is called IBM Verichip and the Fourth Reich. But the traction that we started getting just by, it was just a short 10-minute film. We then released Operation Line Deceive, Verichip style, and then Your Papers, Please. And then there was a fourth one, which was Hypnotized into the Mainframe. The reason, I guess, the One Mainframe to Rule Them All was done was to bring all the information together from all those little short films, but obviously have, better production values to it, you know, just taking more care with the actual end product rather than it just being, you know, a YouTube release, I guess, because we really wanted it to, if the movie was actually watched by, you know, whether it's people in government or people from universities or people that would obviously, you know, criticise the whole movement, if the production was done correctly and was actually documented and historically correct, then you obviously you eliminate the debunkers. Probably took I'd probably say about a year put the whole thing together from you know, getting the interviews, getting Edwin Black on board, and then obviously ensuring as well that when the product was actually released or the film was released, it was still current. So at the rate that Radio Frequency ID is actually marching on, you know, with the release of barcodes and just, you know, this ubiquitous surveillance internet of things that we're moving into, that even though we might not have gone into it in great detail, when you watch the movie, even a year from now, it will still be totally relevant, if that makes sense.
That makes total sense. We interviewed briefly No 2ID on November 5th of this year, or we released it on November 5th of this year, and he espouses complete competence all of the problems with the database state. And I think what we're really dealing with here is the database state, the ability to centralize all kinds of both public and private information into one location to where it can be sifted, managed, and collated to get right down to the individual, to where within a few buttons, someone can pull up every record about you and know every habit you have, and they have an instant dossier if they need it.
Oh, I totally agree. And look, what we need to look at is, you know, from our perspective of why we link the historical side to IBM, I think in the US you have NCR, who does, you know, is mainly your point-of-sale company. Now, when you look at the data processing of the Hollerith machine, which was the tabulating machine, which basically, you know, allowed for the census to be done with IBM during the Nazi Germany year times, you had the processing power of like 64,000 cards per hour. Currently now, when you look at the IBM processing power of their Blue Gene computers that can obviously run, you know, the data mining and the like, you've got now computers that can process, you know, 21 to 22 trillion computations per second. So information is power, it always has been, and once it starts becoming centralized and governments start mandating purchase records and you know, like you said, creating a dossier of who you are as an individual, and then you marry that with radio frequency ID, where most people aren't even aware that the technology exists, you start getting a very good, clear picture, especially coupled then with social networks, you know, like Facebook and MySpace, you start getting a very clear picture of who the individual is. And then you start moving it into where the military-industrial complex is moving the agendas, where they have actually stated that we want to know the adversary before the crime is actually committed. So we're now moving into really into, you know, what was considered science fiction, but we're moving into, you know, functional MRI, which is basically brain scanning. We're moving into internal biometrics, like, you know, ECG, like how your heart rhythm is basically differ from someone else. So what I can see happening is the civilian sphere, as we know it, is now being militarized. And for me, that is extremely scary. It is. There's no two ways about it. And then we mustn't forget as well, you know, when people go, you know, Verichip, you know, it's just a company. Raytheon, which is the fifth largest defence contractor in the world, who manufactures the, you know, the Tomahawk missile, they are the manufacturer of the very chip. So this is a military industrial
product.
Design, and they, but they're going into market with the tech giants as well, as you know, as they always have. So
I'd like to explain that if I could. I know just a tiny bit about that, and through my travels, I've met up with lots of different people. But one of the facts that have come to the surface is that one out of every three new technologies that is developed of any kind are purchased by the U.S. Department of Defense.
Yeah.
Here in America. So when you come up with a new technology, the first people who want to crack at it, the first people to invest in it, the first people to want to dominate it, attain it, and own it are the Department of Defense. So that is, yeah. The technology industry actually becomes somewhat synonymous with the military industrial complex, and that is why. So continue.
I'd agree, Sheila. Totally and utterly. Totally and utterly.
So I think that is kind of one of those things. So we're not going to get away from commingling the profiteering that's made from technologies and new technologies and any kind of defense agenda. But when we're talking about the military of the United States, that is the biggest, scariest machine that I think the world has right now. And they're very tough to deal with. And if you get in the way of their cheddar, you become somebody that is maybe targeted. You might be more unsavory. But you're pretty far from removed from that. And it's interesting to me, especially, because you're kind of tampering with their bread and butter here. What has it been like for you to try to promote this film anywhere?
Yeah, see, for me, I mean, on the military industrial, like, I'm all about living in a safe world. I'm all about having, you know, I understand that there's a political game that operates on a far higher level than what the average person out there basically can understand. But for me, it's a case of when, you know, with one mainframe to rule them all, is when you actually start seeing, you know, dots aligning and the prospect of history actually repeating, you know, with IBM basically conducting the census, but then obviously including Lockheed Martin to GPS, you know, the front doors of American citizens. For me, that becomes more than an actual census. That starts becoming a military operation.
Interesting.
It's not that I'm saying, you know, they're going to round up American citizens. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying, why is this happening and what will happen to the data? So for me, I guess I view our movement as really like a watchman in a sense, just saying, look what's happening out there, and let's flesh this out for debate, because currently how America stands, I mean, you're meant to be the land of the free and the brave, but what is currently happening to you, and that's not to say it's not happening to Australia as well, this is a global phenomena. What is happening is that the civilian is being treated almost as a military adversary. And
or as a product for them to kind of manage.
When you've got, you know, IBM Sam Palmisano, when he addressed the Council of Foreign Relations, he stated people can be networked. And when you have the tech giant, you know, IBM, and you know, Sam Palmisano addressing, you know, the group, the Council of Foreign Relations, basically saying that a human being is, you know, in the same vein as an object or a process or a service, and I can be networked, well, I take great offence to that. It's the way I lead my life does not impact their life, in a sense, but when he starts spouting things like that, well, then that starts affecting my future and the future of my friends, family, and, you know, the rest of the people of the world. So for me, I have no problem when, you know, companies operate for profit, as they all need to, but when profit then starts basically infringing on my civil liberties and starts infringing on my, you know, my human rights, well, that's where my problems come in.
Right. And it does get very personal. And
it does. I mean, look, and people can actually go on to the IBM website. He stated, he goes, you know, people can be networked. And then you have the, you know, the electronic product code, which is, if you marry that to the radio frequency ID, where they've got a certain amount of bits allocated for human beings, where the human being is on the target list just the same as, you know, automobiles or, you know, toys or any other item that's actually manufactured. So, for me, the problem stems from the fact that the way these tech giants and the controllers of this technology view humanity, they don't view you as a flesh and blood being. They view you as something that can be electronically tagged, but more than that, something that can be monetized and something that can be meshed into the internet. And for me, I just think that is a gross violation of my human rights.
I think you're really going there. And a lot of people don't get asked. There's no consent.
Yep.
People become intellectual property at that point. If you can be reduced to a barcode and somehow they manipulate the ownership of a barcode, they can own you somehow. And so the copyright agenda and the intellectual property agenda is becoming these strange, nuanced things, but they always seem to leave the little guy out. The X factor, as we discussed previous to the interview, is the common man. And they're not going to get very far without consent. And I would say if people know what's going on, they see it coming, They find their gall. They find their will to push back, because what they need is consent, and they don't have
yep.
it. They don't have it. They didn't ask, but that's not consent.
And you bring up a very valid point, Sheila, because when people say, you know, what can I do? It's what you can do is you stick to your guns and you keep your free will, and that for me is where the war is actually being fought. It is a case of governments can obviously act you know, in a dominant way to basically enforce agendas, but the way generally it's approached is from a marketing perspective, where, you know, there's nothing better than having a willing client that will actually adopt your agenda. So it's a multifaceted approach to market that they're using, but like you said, it's, you know, consent has to really be handed over unless it is, you know, enforced, which generally you'd hope in this day and age that it doesn't happen.
So let's talk about Australia specifically. How did you bring it full curve to IBM, and then you traveled pretty far, and it came actually full circle back to Austin, Texas. At one point, you indicate that IBM Austin, which is down the road, is the culprit. It is kind of the fulmination. They have the contract to kind of make it all happen.
Yeah. See, for me, I come from the tech industry, so I've worked for Apple and I've worked for Xerox, and I guess for me, when you look at it from a perspective of you have a human implantable radio frequency ID chip and you have a world market, so you have, I don't know whether we're close to 7 billion people now. Hypothetically speaking, you have got the largest target market out of any product that has ever been developed. And when I then saw that, and then we started piecing together on this side, like, okay, who actually owns the product, started seeing the actual, you know, the product being sold down the line from Destron Fearing through to Hughes Aircraft, and then to, you know, when Hughes Aircraft merged with Raytheon, and then obviously having Verichip as being the front person to bring this product into market, I then started getting concerned. I went, okay, here we have now, this is a military industrial complex product. Then when the seed funding from IBM got verified, you know, with the loan in 1999 to, you know, prop up VeriChip, VeriChip was bleeding money like hand over fist. You know, debts were forgiven. That would make absolutely no sense if you're operating from the world of commerce. I then looked and I went, okay, well, you know, what else does why is IBM hiding the ownership of the actual product from their products and services that they're actually offering? So that is when the, you know, the digging and the scratching occurred, and that's obviously when we ran across Edwin Black's work on IBM and the Holocaust.
Wow.
So to cut a long story short, I ordered the book, and I was absolutely floored.
He's tough to get, Greg. He's not easy to get a hold of. He's kind of like one of these obscure, kind of squirrely, philosophical and scholarly type folks that he's not reachable. He's kind of inaccessible. So that is an adventure in and of itself. Edwin Black is the author of Nazi Nexus and IBM and the Holocaust. And he has amazing information about the collation and the use of what I call data lust in order to catalog folks. Now, he's one of the few, and if not the only guy, that's actually done very specific work on how a corporation aided and abetted something like a Holocaust. So he's got important information that I believe, but again, he's kind of difficult. He's difficult to reach, and he's not that accessible. So continue.
Yeah, and look, there was debate on, you know, on how we were going to work together and, you know, how it was going to be done. And look, I also understand from Edwin's perspective, being, you know, in his position, one needs to protect one's position. So for us as well, you know, coming from a different angle, saying, look, you know, this is the VeriChip, you know, et cetera. I guess he had there was a learning curve on his side, but what he could see is we had done the research on our side, he had done the research on his side, and I can say without a shadow of a doubt, even though he was extremely hard at the end of the day, you know, to work with, not to work with, but to get to the point where we could work together, the film itself or our movement and the organisation owes a lot of credit to his work, because it's like anything, if you can't prove the past, how can you warn people about the future? So Edwin's work was just one of those pieces of work that, realistically, if it wasn't for the documentation, if it wasn't for the research, we wouldn't have the platform from which to actually, you know, be the movement that we are today. Because history, you know, what do they say? History can, you know, predict the future, basically.
Yeah, I agree. Now, when you did your research on IBM, one of the most amazing parts of the film, and it may be dry for some more than others, but the research was pristine, and I really prize it because it outlays and it shows the very meticulous path that there were ledgers and there were articles and there was careful PR, buying and trading and selling of how a system like this comes about. And it's all very la-di-da, day-to-day, you know, and no one thinks anything of it. It just is like a feather. It just goes out and no one really kind of acknowledges it, except for if you're sensitive to it, like we are. So tell me how you came about collating this information and doing your research. Did you hire a research assistant? Did you go through an agency? Who helped you?
No, we used two guys, four brothers, in the States, who do the shooting for us. But for me, it was a case of the data is all out there. It's just a case of, you know, putting it together, and regardless of how long it all takes together to ensure that once the product that, you know, that you deliver is correct. So Regardless of, you know, when there's a transaction done, whether it's from IBM to Raytheon and everything like that, all the information really is out there. It just depends how long you want to spend in actually researching it and then putting it together. But for me, the kicker, I guess, where I went, look, this has to be, you know, fleshed out to the nth degree, was why was IBM hiding its portfolio? Like, why, when IBM obviously owned the berry chip or the rights to it or the, you know, the seed funding, why did they hide this from their portfolio? And the simple answer to that is, if you put a human implantable microchip in your portfolio and you are guilty of war crimes for which you have never apologized, and the original IBM number, which basically was the, you know, the Auschwitz, you know, tattoo on the prisoners, it doesn't take much of an expert to then just put it together. So what I did see was there was a direct and concerted effort to actually hide the ownership of the actual human implantable microchip. So for me, once that red flag, you know, when I saw that red flag, that's when, you know, the crime novel, I guess, started unraveling.
Right, because they throughout the film, and this is one of the highlights, is that they did some scrubbing. They it's almost like laundering. They laundered their company dealings.
Yeah.
And the fact that it was kind of like a little mistress. Verichip was almost like a little mistress, kind of tucked away, sold to another, and it was legit, but it wasn't. And
look, how many times, Sheila, that they've spun the name out, you know, it's gone Applied Digital Solutions, they've got Xmark, they're now called Positive ID. You know, how many times
Angel
the company
Digital
has tried to reinvent itself? The fact remains, we have proved without a shadow of a doubt that it's IBM. IBM owns the human implantable microchip, and the cat's out of the bag. And as a result of that, then the question now becomes, what is the rest of the population going to do about this information? Because just like with your work and with our work, how much more can we do? We can only do so much, and then ultimately it rests with the individual. It comes down to the individual saying, look, I will not be treated as inventory, and I will basically, you know, either resist this or educate someone else or take this on board, or I will come home, switch on my plasma TV, drink more beer and watch, you know, is it Monday night football you have there or Tuesday?
Yeah,
I'm not sure.
It's Monday night football.
Monday night. Mm. Yeah, so it's the same, you know, it's the same principles out here. You've got an economy in meltdown. It's not as bad as your economy currently. But, you know, most people are flat out just putting food on the table, keeping their jobs. Inflation's going up. You know, your purchasing power is going down. And as long as, you know, people are in that survival mode, you know, things such as privacy, biometrics, human implantable microchip, they are really philosophical ideas to discuss, you know, of, you know, what constitutes a human being, you know, what is an upgrade, you know, what should be allowed, what shouldn't be allowed. They are really debates for people that either care about it, have the time to care about it, or are in a position financially where they can actually think about it, where the average, you know, man on the street, realistically, is just trying to pay off his mortgage and put food on the table for his kids.
I hear this over and over and over again, Greg. This is consistent. You know, people who work on privacy and identity issues, it's the same thing. You've got the little guy at the bottom of the food chain who wakes up one day and he's like, why the heck am I being asked for all of my information and thumbprint and a urine sample and DNA and everything? You know, why do they need all this? And so when it gets to that level, you know, some people would say, the battle's already lost. But I think that they didn't ask the final person in the process, which is like you have to, again, it goes back to that consent issue. Regardless of how difficult it may or may not be, you have to pick a battle. And identity is one of these things where it's like a bit in the mouth. They want to procure, they want to snatch your identity and make everything almost like a type of currency. Now, I did a paper recently that I published on, you know, a couple of blogs. And the idea is that you don't rely exclusively on money to get goods and services anymore. You must also show a form of identity. So in and of itself, you will not get goods and services with simply money. You must provide identity in conjunction with it. So essentially that's two forms of currency. Otherwise you will not be able to get the specific service or good that you may be trying to get. And they're trying to escalate this type of system because they're sure that identity is something we will all have, no matter if the government system crashes or not. We still have people. And if they can monetize you, then it's easier for them to integrate one system. And it goes back to a philosophy of kind of like feudalism. I call it the new feudalism.
Yes, no, I'd agree with that. And look, where it's going, what people need to realize is this, you know, 30 years ago when biometrics or 20 were starting to be floated around as being the, you know, like your biometric marker is impossible to fake. It's, you know, it's basically the Holy Grail. And at the time, you only had realistically fingerprints. Iris scans were on the horizon. Now we're at a point where you have at least, you know, 12 biometric markers. I mean, from, you know, gait to odor biometrics to, you know, typing biometrics. So it just goes on and on. And then you have EU-funded projects like the Cordis, which have gone on record to say, and I'd recommend your listeners to just research, it's called the Humabio Project. And Humabio has actually gone on record to say, external biometrics are useless to us. We want internal biometrics. So now we're talking brain scans, we're talking heart rhythms. And then the question then becomes, once they have those, the internal biometric markers that they consider more secure, because obviously, you know, they're not external and can't be, you know, spoofed or cloned, the question then, where do we move to from there? And then the answer is functional MRI, which is brain scanning. So where this is all heading to is you're moving into a world which is they're trying to fuse your identity, not only through external biometrics, not only through internal biometrics, but also then matching it to intent to the actual system. So I guess where my position lies is I can see where this is all heading, and it has no end. So that's the point. It's when they have four biometrics of you, they then want your DNA biometrics. Once they have that, they then want, you know, so the question then becomes is, when does it end? And it won't end if people say, look, I've had enough. I think, you know, where we're heading into, I don't want to live in a world that's basically, you know, a George Orwell 1984, where where the civilian is considered the adversary. I find it ridiculous.
Well, I think that people can, again, they can kind of see it coming. If they get advanced warning, they're going to do something, because that's obvious. You know, Real ID in the States was obvious. This thing with CODIS, with DNA tracking, that's obvious. Just because they have the technology, they can buy the technology, they can find someone to buy the technology and try to legislate the technology, does not mean that the technology is going to work, that the system will work. So in our research and in our travels, we've discovered that there are biometrics that don't work, that the systems that they will employ and cause the people to pay for may not be the most effective. They don't achieve the ends that they pretend to achieve, which is national security. They may prove personhood, but they don't provide nationality. They could get someone's DNA. They can get their brain scan. They can get everything about them on their person. But it doesn't prove that they are Australian or Czechoslovakian or, you know, it just gets really, really out there into the God playing or the godhood philosophy of power. And
Entirely, and like what you said before, Sheila, it is data lust. It is a case of the driving force behind this, whether you call it the military or you call it government or you call it, you know. And look, I've spoken to some people within government that they truly believe they are making the populace safer, you know, when they go down the biometrics path. I've spoken to police officers that, you know, that basically say if we can facially scan someone as they're entering into a nightclub, we'll have less problems with, you know, what's currently happening now in Australia, where you have, you know, the younger generation obviously not having, you know, the job prospects that, you know, the future ones had, slightly more angry, drinking more alcohol, more stabbings, you know, just an angrier younger generation simply because, you know, they've been locked out of the housing market, you name it. So the whole thing just permeates through, and it also becomes a very subjective thing where you have one person who's promoting biometrics who actually thinks he's saving the world, and then you have someone else who can actually see, well, you know, this is a slippery slope that we're heading down. So it's just one of those things that just needs to be debated, and debated quite heavily.
I'll even go as far as to say this is lazy government. Anytime you have to put this much of a burden on the people to force identity, we'll just jump through another hoop. Jump through another hoop. We'll get to it later. They're not fixing the system. They're not fixing the problem with the housing market or the financial system. They're not fixing the causation of the problem, because somehow they are able to maintain and keep what they have, if not gain more, by others being at a disadvantage. And that's the slippery slope we're talking about here. And if technology tends to enable kind of the evil geniuses who'd want to dominate the world, well, then God bless the hacker. You know, I'm not saying go run out and be subversive, but that's why God makes hackers.
The systems that they propose, like you said, you know, there are some biometrics that do work and some that don't. And a lot of them can be faked, and we all know radio frequency ID can be cloned. So, you know, in a world that's really in economic meltdown, the amount of money that is actually being spent on, you know, security and the like, you know, as you mentioned briefly before, a lot of the technology that is actually being bought is being bought by, you know, the military first, and then obviously, you know, passed down the line.
Yeah, and so where is Australia at, just out of curiosity, on their processes? I know that there are people in Australia that are working on keeping digital privacy at the forefront and making sure that the government doesn't legislate or pay for anything that makes them less secure in a digital way. So where are they on something like Verichip and regulation?
I'm a bit of a... I guess, look, every time a new biometric measure is announced or a new security measure is announced, we have our, you know, electronic privacy groups and, you know, our you know, protection to civil liberty groups. And quite often you'll read the article and you'll think to yourself, you know, this just looks like a silly chess game once you actually have read the article, and nothing really gets achieved. The point is, the agendas tend to move forward always, the privacy groups always tend to lose, and the crawl on your the identity theft, or them thieving your identity in the name of protection, just continues. So in Australia, I'm very cynical. Like, I mean, you know, we have got some good ties with some good people within government, but like anything, it is very much a political agenda. They don't want to alienate their peers and their, you know, make a mockery of themselves as, you know, conspiracy theorists when anything like this gets tabled in Parliament. So, you know, it's the same old game. You have some honest people and a lot of dishonest people and a lot of indifferent people. And ultimately, we live in a financial system where, you know, people don't want to cut off the hand that's feeding them, and people don't want to go out on a limb and do the greater good, because the greater good quite often alienates you and doesn't put any food on the table.
Well, they've kind of got a design, though. It can be resisted in a reasonable way. I definitely learned of a success against the national ID card system in Australia that I read online. There was an electronic privacy group in Australia that did have some good success with that.
So there are
gains to be made, and I would just encourage you, Greg, what you're doing right now is really going to empower the world. Even though you're in Australia and you're far away, it came home to me. And I live in Austin, Texas, and IBM Austin.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. You know, and I work on this issue very diligently, and this documentary has truth to it, and it deserves to be given adequate promotion. I encourage everyone to visit One Mainframe to Rule Them All on YouTube. And tell them how to reach you and how to get a hold of promotional copies or to actually buy the DVD.
Look, it's not monetized, so obviously, you know, people just visit the website, which is wethepeoplewillnotbechipped.com or noverychipinside.com. It'll lead you to the same website. The video itself can obviously, you know, we want it distributed. If you want to actually get a high-res version of that, please just email the site and we'll, you know, we'll send the send it file through to you so you can actually burn copies. So the information like this realistically can't be monetized because the, you know, I mean, obviously we live in a financial world, but, you know, sometimes there's certain messages that have to reach the masses above all things, and I just consider that one of these messages.
That's fantastic. So thank you for being with us, Greg Nicoletos of We the People Will Not Be Chipped. And any parting shots?
No, I'll actually contact you. We'll get involved in part two of the movie. So no, I appreciate it. And it's like anything, you keep doing what you're doing. We need more people like you as well.
Yes. And anyone who's listening, anything you do is better than nothing.